Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the podcast with a K, available on iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
Welcome to the podcast with a K.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and this is the podcast with a K with me, Christian Corley, and, well, actually, it's just me. And a selection of guests who I will introduce you to in a moment. We're talking this week to the team behind Doctor Who Legacy. And no James or Brian required. We have got quite a few people. Oh, and don't forget to listen through to the end for a special giveaway code from the Doctor Who Legacy team. Let's get on with it.
Yeah, excellent. Oh, okay, so we're all here and present and correct. So this is Podcast with a K, and we are talking... this week to the Doctor Who Legacy / Pixel Who team, and we're discussing the game as it is at the moment. So with us, if you could all say hello for the listener, we do only have the one. So we've got Susan and Lee Cummings.
Hello.
Hello.
We have George Mann.
Hello.
We have Nathan Skreslet and Lee Cow.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, it's actually Lee Gao, but
Lee
no worries.
Gao,
it's
thank you, pardon.
Yes. No worries. It's a
I
difficult last name.
I'm sorry, Lee.
It's okay. I think it's always easier when people call me Pixel Lee. I'm like, yeah, that's fine. Go with that.
Right, I'll call you Pixel Lee. Just writing that down. Pixel Lee. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's how we always figured out to distinguish between Lee Cummings and myself, because whenever we were on joint talks, it was always difficult to...
Yeah, who are we talking about?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Okay. Right. So I'm going to start talking to Susan and Lee, because obviously we've spoken in the past on the podcast, way back when Doctor Who Legacy started. And we also did a little bit of a chat for the Casterbis magazine. I'm talking about Casterbis as if it's still an ongoing thing, and it's like, I'm getting a bit teary about this. But obviously, things have come on like considerably since 2013 for you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things. When we launched the game, we said we were going to keep going until we hit an earthly child. And but I think in like the day and age of gaming, where people are, you know, everyone's very fickle. We're all very fickle because, you know, we have mobile games and PC games and console games, and no one really expects anything to last that long. Mm-hmm. So I think the fact that we're going to hit our third anniversary in November. Is a massive accomplishment and bonkers in and of itself in this day and age. So yeah, it's crazy. And we're up over, I think, roughly 120 hours of gameplay for, you know, the average person. And, you know, we've brought together so many facets of Doctor Who now between, you know, the core series, the classic series, the Titan Comics, Big Finish, getting George, who wrote Engines of War, involved. Now for the Doctor Who magazine 500th issue, we brought in Frobisher and Absalom Duck and Shade. So there's almost like no piece of Doctor Who universe that we don't touch on in some way within the game.
You just need the new adventures, don't you?
We do, yeah. And I should say, and we have some Torchwood and Sarah Jane. So we don't have class yet, but okay. Maybe.
Yeah, so you want class, you want the pre-Doctor Who magazine comics from TV Comics and that stuff, and you want the Virgin New Adventures, and then you got the full set.
Exactly, yeah. We'll get there. But I think that that's what's been really cool about it, and I think what's allowed it to last so long is that there's something for everyone in it, and I think that that was what we were really hoping to be, was something that allowed you to, you know, sort of embed yourself in the bits of the Doctor Who universe that you love, and maybe find out about bits that you didn't even know about. So I think that's what's been really cool about him.
Okay. Now, as you may know, and the listener's probably aware of this, because I do bang on about it probably every week, I work mainly as a technology journalist, and from time to time I'm fortunate enough to review games, and usually the reviews kind of, I change my mind over time. I was just looking at Doctor Who Legacy on Google Play, and the first review I find is mine.
Awesome. I hope it was good.
yeah, it was a 5-star review.
Cerberus was always so kind to us. I mean, that's it was you guys have been awesome to us, or your old company, I should say, was awesome to us.
Yeah, Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of a bit of an obsession with mine, sort of like computer games on Doctor Who, sort of. I was always so very disappointed that I couldn't get off the first level of Dalek Attack back in the 90s on my Amiga. So, but as I say, often I change my mind about games as time goes on, and I wouldn't give them the high rating that I did. But with Doctor Who Legacy, I would. And, you know, if it was the Doctor Who Legacy that came out in 2013, then without a doubt, I would have revised that score down. But the fact that you keep adding stuff and adding stuff to it, levels and characters and the other stuff and the Pixel Who stuff that we'll get onto in a moment, it keeps the interest high, and it the engagement increases, or you retain the engagement.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, we have a core of, you know, we've had over 2 million people play the game now. I think it's pushing towards like 2.25 million people. And there's a core of, call it a 250,000 people, who've been playing since day one. And I think we'll never stop. As long as we keep putting up. And maybe they'll keep playing after we stop putting
up. Until we add so much art to this game that the install is huge and he's confident they're filming.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest problem, is eventually it just becomes a bloated mess of a game, and it's just too big for everyone's phones. But I think that's what's helped us to do that, is the fact that, you know, we've gotten into this cycle of putting new stuff out each week, and we've kind of gotten that down to a science. And you know, we're better at it than we were back then. I think if we launched the game now, it'd be a better game than it was back then, because we've added so many cool features that ideally would have been in there from the beginning. But you know, you live and learn, and I think we keep finding ways to make the product better.
Okay, I'm going to strangely, I'm going to skip over the gentleman who could be considered our star guest, George, and I'm going to speak to the Pixel Who people now. So Nathan and Lee, hello, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
With a K. Now, a few years ago, I think was it 2012 or 2013, you had the Pixel Who on Kickstarter, didn't you?
Yes, yeah, we actually started back in 2011 was when the artwork really started.
Right.
And it was always sort of Nathan's love letter to the show for all the creativity that has gone into it over the last 50 plus years at this point. Because honestly, since he was 8, he's always wanted to represent every single character that's ever shown up, was always his ultimate goal. And he realized for him that it would take forever if he rendered them exactly as he saw them. So at the time, he had a huge nostalgia kick for 80s video games. And that's kind of where Pixel Who kind of came about, because he wanted to do a mixture of the two.
Yeah, it was around the time that things like, you know, retro games were starting to come back on Kickstarters, and, you know, Minecraft was you know, bringing back that sort of retro style. And a light bulb just kind of went off in my head. I go, you know what? That might be a great way to simplify all of these characters down to sort of their core essence. You know, and render them relatively quickly, and in a graphic way.
Yes, yeah. So that's when he did all this artwork, and we actually did the very first poster on our own. And we wanted to continue doing it, and that's when we realized that we didn't quite have the financial backing to do that. So that's when we did the Kickstarter, and that's when you all, I guess, either contacted us or we contacted them.
Yeah, poster printing is remarkably expensive.
Yes.
So, yeah, that was part of the impetus behind the Kickstarter. And also, it really helped to get people to see the project. Yeah. I think a lot of folks found us through that who otherwise wouldn't have.
Yeah, and actually, it was really nice. It was actually a huge morale boost, because we weren't sure if we had anything. We were like, we love doing this, but I have no idea if anyone else likes this. And actually, from that, just shipping out rewards and stuff. I think how many, like 22 countries?
Oh, yeah, all over the world. Yeah, yeah. It was really kind of heartening to know that there are fans, you know, scattered everywhere.
It was like Federation of Russia. It was like...
Yeah, it was shipped to Australia. And,
Zimbabwe. We had one in Zimbabwe. It was amazing.
All over the place.
And it just let us know like how much Doctor Who had touched everyone really across the world, and how our artwork seemed to speak to them as well. So it was nice, because it was nice to actually get that little bit of a boost to know that other people actually really enjoyed what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm going to include a snap of one of the examples of the Pixel Who are in the podcast show notes. But I've just pulled up an article from Casterbris from 2013, March 2013. And it says here, because, you know, people might be thinking, well, it must be really easy just to, like, make stuff like that with, you know, way computer software is at the moment. But it specifically says here, every pixel is individually laid by hand. There's no conversion program used, is there, to, so, like, convert, so, like, you know, David Tennant, as he is on screen, into a block of, sort of large pixels, is there? It's all done manually.
Right. Yeah, we don't use any kind of automatic algorithms. It's literally myself, you know, in Photoshop with a grid and you know, a paint bucket tool, basically. You know, selecting the areas I want and choosing the color tones and putting them together myself, sort of through my own interpretation of what I'm seeing. Usually, I'll have reference images on one screen. As I'm working and flipping back and forth, sometimes I'll have the episodes freeze framed on another screen above me that I can use for reference as well. I have to build everything literally square by square.
Yeah, he's a little humble about this. It does actually still take him a lot of time because he's actually the only person who does it. I don't do any of the artwork myself. But yeah, his actual setup at home, he's got three monitors going. One of them is the actual grid that he created within the program to meet the size that he wanted for the amount of DPI he wanted. And then the other screens are all of his references where he's just sitting there just going dot, 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 going, you know what? That needs to move half a pixel over to look slightly closer to what we're going for. Yeah.
Oh, for our listeners, we should probably define DPI as dots per inch.
Yes. Sure. Yeah, he has a very specific number so that all of the characters match each other.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that makes sense, yeah. How long would it take to do a single character, then?
It highly depends on their complexity. I would say the average sort of humanoid character can be anywhere from, 20 minutes to an hour, depending on how difficult the likeness is to nail. Larger characters or more complex ones could take an entire day or even several days by themselves. I think on one of our posters, we did Kroll, from, you know, Power of Kroll, and he's about, oh, I don't know, when printed, he's probably 5 or 6 inches tall. He's probably got about 500 to, you know, 1,000 squares just of himself.
Mm-hmm. How long did the Cyber King take you?
Oh, Lord, long time. I think that was a couple of days.
Wow.
Yeah, and all the background work that Nathan does for the game as well is all new. It's all, we hadn't done any of those before, and those take them sometimes a few weeks.
Yeah, we do pixelated sort of background plates or scenes for the characters to exist in. Those can sometimes be even more time consuming than the characters themselves because every inch is filled.
Many years ago, there was a game called Shoot 'em Up Construction Kit. I'll call it a game. There was a piece of software called Shoot 'em Up Construction Kit. I don't know. It was available on the Commodore 64, maybe some others. And basically, you'd create your little sprites using a sort of a grid, and you'd like put in your limited choice of 16 colours. And I made about 2 games on this. It was absolutely back-breaking, neck-aching work. I have the utmost respect for and admiration for the amount of time and effort that you put into doing this. It's amazing.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. We like to joke that our art style for this is, it's like 8 to 16 bit, but with 32 bit capability, because we're not restricted to the color gamut that they were back in the day.
Sure.
And we can do some more sophisticated things than they could, but, it's still a lot of manual labor.
Yeah. Okay. So that's you guys, that's Pixel Who. So how did Pixel Who get together with Doctor Who Legacy? How did that come about?
I think we had been doing this for about 3 or 4 years. We've been doing the conventions and just continually making the artwork. And it was actually Lee Cummings who approached us first and contacted us.
Yeah, I think he messaged me through Facebook, actually.
He found our Facebook page.
Yeah.
Yeah, our Pixel Who Facebook page. And
I
can't remember what led me to the Facebook page, but something led me there. And I just I thought, this is awesome. And I'm such an old school gamer. I feel really old every time I say I was playing games in a minute. I really, really liked it. And I was like, well, there must be some way we can do something with these guys. And it led here.
So was that your initial thought, that you could do something with it? Or was it more of a case of, I just want to say hello?
No, I think from the very beginning, I knew I wanted to. I can't remember what I said originally, but I'm sure by the end of the night, we had agreed we were doing something. So it very quickly turned into that.
Yeah, I think initially I was like, are these people real? Are they? I can't Let me look it up. So I looked up both Susan and Lee. And I was like, oh, they're like legitimate like developers, and like they actually have this huge like, you know, background in video games. And I was like, oh my gosh, yes, just tell them yes, whatever. Let's work with them. I, you know, really want to be a part of this game. And yeah, so it was actually quite
and
exciting.
And we could tell like within about 10 to 15 minutes of talking to Lee that, you know, he was a genuine fan just like us, and you know, they were really awesome people, and we really wanted to work with them.
That's the thing with everyone that we've worked with on this, we've become good friends with. Like, you know, we love Nathan Lee, you know, we love George, we love the guys at Titan that we've worked with on this, and Peter at the BBC. You know, all of these people have just sort of been united sort of first and foremost in the fact that we love Doctor Who. And secondary to that, we're making a cool game and we hope it's successful and people play it and stuff. But I think that the fact that it's all united around this sort of fandom is what's made it such a cool project, you know?
Okay. We're... Well, as you know, we've been speaking for 17 minutes. We haven't said anything to George. Hello, George.
Poor George.
Don't worry about me. I've been enjoying listening.
George Mann, writer of Engines of War, and you are the man behind Bigger on the Inside.
Certainly the script of it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, part of it, yeah. Is it episode one or part one? Or is it
it's chapter one.
Chapter one.
Prologue, and now this is chapter one.
Chapter one. So presumably many more chapters planned beyond this.
Well, hopefully at least one more. At least one more.
Yeah. In the storyline, yeah.
Well, originally when I started sketching out the story, it was like seven chapters, and when it came down to the more realistic way of doing this, it's more like two big chapters in the prologue.
An ungodly amount of clearance goes into each of these chapters. I mean, that's
This. I mean, chapter one kind of grew, didn't it? As we worked on it, really. You know, there's kind of three chapters inside chapter one, really, in the way it tells the story from different perspectives and moves through time, different sets of characters. So there's lots of kind of meat in there for people to get their teeth into.
Okay. Can you tell us a bit about the original monster, which is a big selling point for this, the History Eater?
Yeah, well, it's that's kind of when I first got talking to Lee and Susan about doing a kind of a bigger project, because we'd done a few levels beforehand introducing the character Cinder from Engines of War into the game. That's how I'd kind of got to know these guys. And I just kind of dropped them a line. I went full-time freelance last year, and I dropped them a line and said, I've gone full-time freelance. I'd love to kind of talk to you guys about opportunities. And it just happened to coincide with these guys wanting to do something bigger on the inside. And so Lee had already been talking to the BBC about the idea of introducing a new monster specific to the game. Kind of we wanted to do something. We talked it through quite at length, and we wanted to do something that felt new and different, and a big threat that even the Daleks would be scared of, really, was kind of the brief that Lee gave me there. So we kind of ended up throwing ideas back and forth. And yeah, this is a monster that kind of eats timelines. You know, even as I mentioned, the Daleks don't know what to do to stop it. First reared its head during the Time War, and now later is making a comeback and threatening the Doctor and the TARDIS and all of history, really, at different points in the timeline. So that's why we're kind of seeing different eras of Doctor Who presenting themselves
within Doctor Who Legacy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what you've got. There's a virus in the TARDIS, and you've got the TARDIS is kind of recreating different eras and different monsters and different characters as the Doctor's trying to figure out what's going on. So you've got. That's one of the things I love about Doctor Who Legacy is that you've got these team-ups that you wouldn't see in any other medium of Doctor Who, really. So we've got the Eighth Doctor and the War Doctor and comic companions from the book, and then Grace coming back as well, all kind of in one story. You know, in the prologue and the first part of Chapter 1, you've got the First Doctor with Porridge and Jack Harkness. Yeah. Again, that's a team-up you're never going to see in any other medium, really. But the story and the framework that these guys had kind of put together, which I then came in and added to, has really given us that opportunity to explore these kind of great team-ups of different characters that and interactions between those characters, which have been a lot of fun to write.
It's interesting that you mentioned those team-ups, because when I was playing it last night, and it took me a moment to realise who Porridge was. Obviously, I recognised Jack, and then I was, instantly, I was taken... And, you know, I've played Doctor Who Legacy before, so, you know, I'm used to the different companions appearing. I was taken instantly back to Dimensions in Time.
Mm-hmm.
With the, you know, the wrong companion appearing with the wrong Doctor and that sort of thing. which, you know, that isn't a bad thing for me, because we did a commentary on Dimensions in Time a few months ago, and I've gained a kind of renewed respect for it, to be honest with you. It has its faults. But it's a lot of fun, so it's a good thing to have in the game, really.
Yeah, I think it's you know, you're talking about a show that's fundamentally about space and time and timelines, and I think, again, you know, we're working in a nice kind of bubble here where there's a story reason why all of this is happening, but it's you know, it's great to be able to pluck these characters from the rich history of Doctor Who and put them together, and you know, as Susan was saying earlier, you've got characters that are from different mediums that you're never going to see on a TV episode of Doctor Who. You know, sometimes the actors have passed away, sometimes they're comic heroes that have never been cast, and being able to kind of test the interaction between those characters and see how the Doctor would behave, or see how the Doctor feels faced with old companions who, you know, might have parted under difficult circumstances and all of those kind of things. It helps shed light on the Doctor's character and the characters that you know we're exploring.
Okay, George, you're from Darlington.
I am indeed. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. I'm in Redcar.
Oh wow, the stomping ground of my youth.
Is it really?
Yeah, we used to go to Redcar on the beach with the dog all the time.
Oh yeah, excellent. Lovely beach here. Yeah, I don't get to it as much as I should. Sorry, everyone. I just wanted to quickly check up on what George has done previously. And I wanted to know what differences there are between writing fiction in novel form and then preparing, I presume, a kind of a narrative section and various dialogues for a game.
Wow, it's very different, actually. It's more akin. I've written a number of Doctor Who comics as well, and it was closer to writing a comic than it was to writing a novel. I mean, in the sense that, you know, as a writer, writing a script for a game or a comic is, you're not doing all the heavy lifting alone. It's a great collaborative process, because you know what the end consumer is going to get isn't what you're writing. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a novel, it's all on your shoulders. You know, if a character walks into a room, you've got to describe that room, and you've got to describe the characters in the room, and you know, before you even get to the dialogue. With a game script or a comic script, you're writing for your collaborators. Say, you know, it's this sort of room, you know, but you've got to leave space for the other creators to do their thing, to add and embellish. But at the same time, you've got to be really true to the characters in the same way you would be in a novel. You know, make sure that when one of the characters speaks, it sounds like they should sound. Mm. And then the additional element here really was, you know, I play the game. I know how the game works. So I was kind of layering in suggestions for, well, maybe in this scene, you know, we'll have these bits of dialogue, and then this sort of fight can happen. You know, the Doctor and this team could fight some Ice Warriors, and then after that we'll have a bit more dialogue, and then maybe they could fight some Zygons. And you know, suggestions that the guys who are a lot more kind of have got a lot more expertise in that side of things would then tweak and change and mold, so that we ended up with a whole package. But I think, so you know, you've got to think about the medium you're writing for. And what works well in a game isn't going to be the same as what works well in a book, or what works well in a comic, or an audio, in fact, as well. So there's bits you can pick up from having done work in those different things, but I guess the key really is to know the medium you're working in. So spend time playing the game, so that when you write for the game, it's appropriate, I guess.
And it's a huge thing for us to have be a part of the game, obviously, with Susan and Lee, but then also to have George writing about the characters.
Yeah, and I gotta say, when we first got George's script, the thing I was most impressed by was how he's able to nail the characterizations of many, many people. You know, he's writing for I don't know how many characters are in these chapters, but it's a lot. And he's only got a few sentences for each one.
Yeah,
you know, to work with.
I think the collaboration with Lee and George on the script was really good.
Yeah, we were super impressed.
Well, much appreciated. But yeah, that's the truth of it is it's, you know, it's no one person's work here. It's, you know, it's a team effort. And what a team to work with. Everyone's contributed and added to it, and it's made it a better thing because of that.
I think it's really the best thing that we've put out in the game. I mean, honestly, between, you know, the great work that these guys did, and then our tech partner, the only guy who's not on the call, Seed in Taiwan, they really upped the ante on what we could do on the scripting side to really make the dialogue come alive. Kunda, who is our sort of lead designer over there, just did some phenomenal work to really just, you know, the sort of bring out the humor of it with the animation that he's added to the game.
Yeah,
we didn't have to put it to do early on, and it really made the script come alive in a way we haven't been able to do before.
Absolutely. It was really great because the artwork for us, it's always been static. So, you know, with the added animations from the studio, it was fantastic.
Yeah, we love what they do.
Yeah, we were like, oh, I've never seen.
I laughed, you know, so many times playing through it, and testing it. Like, it's just so quirky and cute.
It's nice that it came out overall such a light, a really light story and a light visualization of that story. Because when we started, mm-hmm. our first few conversations, they were quite dark, weren't they, George? There's some dark beats in that story, but it manages, even though they're in there, to stay really light.
In a way that Doctor Who does, right?
In a way that Doctor Who does, but in a sort of a different way, you know, in a very cutesy way with the animations and then it all working together really well.
Yeah.
It was nice that it kept that levity.
Absolutely. I think that's like you're saying, one of the great things about Doctor Who in its many different forms is that you get that lightness of touch and that humour that kind of that makes the darker stuff look darker and the lighter mm-hmm. stuff looks lighter because of it. You get that contrast. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, the work these guys do on the pixel art is, I mean, it always just makes me smile as soon as I see it. It's just fantastic.
I will say it was a real joy of Nathan's too. Do the first visual references for your characters from the book, the Skaro degradations.
It's a real joy to see them because that's the first time anyone's ever done anything with them. And, you know, from my point of view, it feels like they're kind of getting some extra validity, you know, because they're moving from one format to another, becoming more a part of the universe than they were, which is a wonderful experience.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. In this particular chapter, Nathan did more original pixelated artwork outside of what's been on the show than he's ever done, and he really enjoyed it. Like, you did the TARDIS Plaza, which was quite a bit of fun, and he had more leeway with that.
Yeah.
The backgrounds, I think, are particularly lovely in this storyline.
Oh, yeah, they're all amazing, yeah. And especially seeing some of the newer locations, like the Cloister Wraith and the cloisters underneath Gallifrey.
Yeah.
Very spooky.
Yeah, yes.
They're wonderful.
I'm always impressed with what Nathan can do with the kind of restrictions that he does have with pixelated artwork. I think we had a fan who once described it as modern artwork, and I hadn't even looked at it that way, but it is. It's very basic, simplified, but it has to be able to convey what it's trying to be in restricted amount of color. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm interested to know, Susan and Lee, you are in a kind of almost unique position in having pretty much the only Doctor Who game on the market.
Yeah.
That deserves a huzzah, yes.
You know, things like Star Wars and Transformers and Star Trek, they all have multiple games. Doctor Who's pretty much got you and then a level pack on Dimensions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
which is a lot of fun, and I think
it was. It's pretty awesome.
It is. Yeah.
I would love there to be just a Doctor Who Lego game.
Yeah, same here.
That would be great. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, how does that feel having that? Is it a power that you have, or is it an honor? Is it something prestigious?
I think it's really gratifying. It's also a big burden to carry too, don't you think, Lee?
Yeah, it's scary because you're like, why aren't there more? why am I all alone here in the middle of this ocean? I could be more people here.
I mean, you know, I think the thing that, because obviously there have been other Doctor Who games. I think that the thing that really worked for us was, you know, early on when we decided to make the game, Lee really felt strongly that what had been a hindrance for Doctor games in the past was the focus on one Doctor, one companion. But in a property that's been alive as long as this one has, that doesn't really cover enough of the Doctor Who audience, because everyone's got their Doctor. Everyone has.
You need to be much more
all
inclusive. That was one of the big issues I had with the early games, or the early games, was you'd have one Doctor, a couple of companions, and if you didn't love those characters, you were in for, you know, a bit of a lackluster experience. And I wanted the opposite, where you can have anyone at any time, put them all together, make a perfect team, and and go in that way into the experience.
And has mashed them together in a neat way. The fact that, you know, we've gotten to know a lot of the actors, which is one of the sort of cooler perks of doing this, has been going to all these events like the Pixel Who guys do, getting to know people like Katie Manning alongside modern people like meeting Michelle Gomez. And the fact that we sort of offer them all an opportunity to mash up together in this game, I think is really
special. And it's a very different world than it was 5 years ago. You know, we have mobile games, which we updated constantly versus, you know, what we had 5 years ago with the other Doctor Who games. And we can add content constantly as people join the show, as people, you know, jump on a convention circuit. So it's something which hasn't been able to exist before.
It's been neat for the new actors, right? Like when Courtney Wood was on, two seasons ago, she came up to us at Gallifrey One and she's like, I don't play games at all. Help me install this on my phone. I gave her a code to unlock like everything in the game. And she's like, oh my God, you know? So, you know, it's like a lot of the newer actors really get a kick out of it because a lot of them grew up loving Doctor Who. I mean, even Peter Capaldi grew up loving Doctor Who and now they're in it. And so I think a lot of the newer actors have gotten a kick out of the fact that they're also in a game. The guy who played Riggsy is awesome, and he's interfaced with us loads of times on Twitter. He actually changed his Twitter page with a game image of him. So these guys have all been really into the fact that they're actually in a video game because they grew up playing games too. It's a younger generation of
being all inclusive helps all the time, especially, you know, with all these people. They're all famous actors. They have fandoms, and it's great. Yeah. You don't just lock yourself to one Doctor and a couple of companions. You can, you know, have free reign over like the whole of history.
Yeah.
Okay. There is. I mean, as we've established, that you're the only Doctor Who game. But I mean, there are other developers who have tried Doctor Who games. I know of two that I've been involved with, had a go at it, and found it quite difficult to sort of come to terms with the BBC side of things. But you have a great relationship with the BBC, don't you?
Yeah.
Oh, we have an amazing... We had a very interesting start, though. We signed the deal through their LA office, and all the way through development until about 6 weeks before we launched, we had a producer in LA, and he was an ex-gaming guy called Ben Badgett, and he helped write the original story, and he was great. He helped define the original art style. And Paul, his boss, yeah. And they were amazing. And then suddenly, as we were about to launch, they shut the office down and transferred us to the London office.
They're like, let us introduce you to your new producer. And we're like, oh,
which
Jesus
could be
Christ.
The worst thing in the world, because it could have easily been, new producer wants to
change
everything.
Yeah.
And we were terrified. But he wasn't. He was the exact opposite.
Peter's been marvelously hands-off about anything to do with gameplay decisions. Like, yeah, he he's been making games for years. Peter comes from Eidos and SCI and all this. So he understands games and his...
He knows when to help and how he can help and when to just let us just make games.
Yeah. I mean, he's really the perfect external producer who's just like, I'm not here to tell you how to do what you do. That's why we signed the game with you. I'm just here to make sure that you don't run sort of in violation of canon, which is what the brand should be there for. And
stop us from making enemies in the brand team.
Yeah, exactly. And to enable us. You know, he's gone to bat for us countless times over the last few years to get things that we needed signed or approved or done in time. And I mean, rather notoriously to some of our followers, we launched a week later than we thought we were going to because we had one character, and I don't want to say one character, who hadn't signed off and prevented us from launching day and date with the 50th anniversary. So yeah, and he was up late nights with me trying to get this done. So, you know, he's always at our back. So, and the brand team in Cardiff's been great too.
I think that's another thing. You know, when you make a game at the beginning, when you don't know anybody in a process. It took us a year to learn the names of all the people we needed to do at the BBC and at the brand team.
Well, and on the story side, right? We were told to stay far away from the story, weren't we?
Yeah, now we're just cracking the story. But when you launch a game without a long tail on it, you know, you launch a game and you can't build those relationships. You know, the massive advantage of having a game that runs for 3 years, at the end of 3 years,
everyone knows you
and they're happy with what you do and they know that it's just going to be an easy sign off on, you know, I hope on most things when they turn up.
Well, and they know that they can trust us on scripts. You know, with the last two series of the show, we did weekend content alongside the new episode, and that's meant having privileged access to pictures from the sets and stuff for our team in Taiwan. But you know, we've proven that we've never had a leak. So that's been a pretty straightforward process for us, and it's made that possible.
Yeah, to be perfectly honest, every time you all write to us and say, hey, your pixel characters, this and this have been approved, and we're like, oh, our artwork's being approved.
Yeah, we very rarely get changes. And, you know, once in a while, we just get a character, and this is really, the pixel guys haven't had any issues with this. On the sort of hyper-realistic side of what Pest does at Seed, there are a few characters that are just really difficult to draw that, you know, we've gotten into long iterations on. Tom Baker comes to mind. Jesus Christ. The BBC had this one image in mind, and it's a really hard face to capture the way Pest draws, and it just ended up looking like lots of wrinkles and lines. And so every once in a while we get a character that just seems to sit in limbo forever. But that's rare.
Has that side of things, or just the game in general, has it changed your relationship with Doctor Who as a fiction? Do you now find, you maybe, you know, when you've done solid levels or you brought in characters that maybe didn't see that much time in Doctor Who, do you find that your relationship with the show and those characters has changed?
I have a tough time watching new seasons because I have to know quite a lot about what's going on in the characters, and I've seen,
what's the episode
costumes
you still haven't watched? The one where you see him as a child, Asleep No More or whatever?
There's two from the last 2 years I haven't seen
yet. Yeah, he missed it. I just go back and watch it.
When you spend all week putting together the stuff specifically for that episode, I haven't seen it, but I know enough about it that it just feels like rolling spoilers for an hour.
Yeah.
So it's been tough to adapt.
He really protects me from the spoilers. He tends to hear the happy conversations.
Yeah, what I do is try to protect Sue as much as I can, and she doesn't see anything that she doesn't absolutely need to. So she doesn't get really
I protect
much.
Him from everything else. So this is my
she protects me from the old things in the world, and I protect her from that.
From Doctor Who spoilers.
Yeah, there we are.
Tit for tat, you know.
Nathan, what about you? When you're creating a piece of art, does your relationship with the character you're interpreting, does that change whilst you're working on them?
It does, in the sense that I pay a lot more attention to the way that characters are dressed, the way that they're designed, and I find myself, you know, sort of memorizing details that I probably otherwise wouldn't even notice because I know I'll have to use it later.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's even things like the artwork that we do is always full body, so it's things right down to he's like, they didn't show what their shoes
looked
like.
Yeah,
I gotta
believe,
look that up.
Actually, next time you watch a television program, try and count the number of times they show a character from the waist down.
Oh my God, yes.
It's very rare. Even if they do show a full body character, usually they're very far away. So getting those details, like what kind of shoes somebody's wearing, can be really difficult. We often have to refer to like on-set photography or promotional pics or that kind of thing, to get those kinds of details.
Yeah, so we'll watch an episode and he's like, oh, they didn't show their bottom half, darn it, I gotta go look it up later.
Funny story here. We've especially had this trouble with classic Doctor Who characters like Susan.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Holly Wright, and they haven't been in recent stuff, so there's only a few episodes. Some of the episodes are lost. Holly Wright, we had this issue. We finally nailed a costume that we thought was right, and it turned out it was from a different show. Do you remember?
Oh.
Put it out, and it turned out it was from she was in something else, Saint or something. The Saint.
Oh, yeah.
And we had to go back and fix it. Nobody caught it because it was all these, you know, old set pictures and stuff, and it was just mixed up in something else. So yeah, it's really tough with the old actors.
Maybe shoes are really expensive. Maybe it was cut.
They were all walking around barefoot. Yes.
And they would bring out like a special glass case. It was like, quick, take the shoes out. You can have them for 2 minutes. Get the shot. Yes.
We're gonna return them. Keep the tags on them. Yeah, yeah, it was actually the same thing. Even with the 12th Doctor when they first showed him with season 9, it was such a quick clip with him and the guitar. And his sonic sunglasses at the time, but no one really knew, you know, without spoilers, what that was all about. And the amount of reference searching Nathan had to do in order to get that image.
Mm-hmm.
It took him real life. He's like, I need to know what pants he's wearing. Like, he's like, it's kind of dark in this photo.
Yeah. Oh, here's another interesting thing that happened when I was building one of the new backgrounds for this level set is the fourth Doctor's wooden console room, which is only in one season, I think, of the original show. I discovered in looking up reference, that set was never put together the same way twice. They moved around the walls and the door positions every time they set it up for whatever shot they wanted to do. So there was no consistency in the way that room is constructed.
Wow.
Yeah. So these are the kinds of challenges that we have to, you know, surmount.
He's like, the door is on the left, the door is on the right. That wall is much closer now for some reason. Why is it closer?
There's furniture in this room. Now there's not. Where'd it go?
It was daytime. Why is it suddenly nighttime?
Yeah.
I guess the fourth Doctor got tired of his console, and he would try and switch it a lot. His desktop, as it were.
Presumably that's something that you can make a joke of within game, though, and just like reconfigure the room every time it appears.
My favorite unspoken joke is the fact that at this point we have like 200 companions and every Doctor all jammed into the TARDIS at once. Like, could you imagine the visual of that?
Oh my goodness, yeah.
And Nathan, actually, he has a lot of fun looking for Easter eggs to stick in all of his backgrounds too. So like the fourth Doctor console, I think it's mostly with the console rooms, but he, if you all look carefully, you actually see a shaving mirror that he's stuck on top in the middle.
Yeah. Excellent.
Brilliant.
Okay, I'm going to ask a similar question to you, George. But you're most closely associated with one particular Doctor, aren't you?
The War Doctor.
The War Doctor, yeah. And I mean, do you feel any kind of responsibility for the War Doctor?
Ooh, blimey. not now, I don't. I mean, I guess it's not my place to feel that responsibility, because he's not mine. But,
sure.
But while he was in my care, absolutely, yes. So when I was writing that book, and, you know, and I didn't know at the time that it was going to be the only novel that was going to feature the War Doctor. So I was very much trying to write a prequel to the episode we'd seen, effectively. That's kind of the brief I'd had from the BBC. I wanted to make sure that not only was I making the character sound like John Hurt's performance, that I was adding some depth to some, hoping to kind of help people to understand why he is the way he is when you see him on screen, to kind of add some reasoning behind kind of the mental state he's in, the thing that would trigger him to go and take the moment from the vault. I felt a huge amount of responsibility there. And just like, you know, the guys were saying, the BBC were brilliant about it all. They let me do so much. In some ways, that story is a sequel to The Five Doctors. We get to go to the Death Zone and Rassilon and Barossa and all that stuff. And bringing elements of the classic show as well as the modern show, and trying to bridge that gap. And I'm amazed they let me get away with what I got away with.
Did you find, because this how it seems to me is it's a kind of reverse Eighth Doctor, where you have the Eighth Doctor appears on TV in 1996, and then everything after is based on that sort of. Well, Pomegan's only on screen from sort of like 25 minutes in,
yeah.
So he doesn't even get. I don't think he gets a full hour. And with the War Doctor, you've got it in sort of reverse, haven't you? Because he already exists and he's been having adventures, so you're filling in the gaps that must then, as you say, thread into what we do know about him.
Yeah, absolutely that. Yeah, it's very similar actually to the Eighth Doctor in that sense. Yeah, you've got this small amount of screen time to work from. And yeah, like, I suppose that you're right, the word is responsibility to kind of remain true to that character and show parts of that journey that's taken him to that point, without kind of disrupting anything. I suppose I suppose what we see with the Eighth Doctor is where he starts, and what we see with the War Doctor is where he ends.
Sure, yeah.
And actually, the two things between the two, there's a massive chasm, isn't there? Which is one of the reasons why, when I got the opportunity to write some Titan comics, I opted for the Eighth Doctor, because I wanted to do some stuff kind of early on in the Time War, when he's still trying to ignore it and pretend it's not really happening. In a run up to Night of the Doctor, because I was effectively trying to bookend the Time War, you know, with the fiction that I've been creating, and that's one of the things that's been great about what we got to do with Bigger on the Inside, because you get to put the Eighth Doctor and the War Doctor together with the companions that I was fortunate enough to be able to create, and tell a story with them both, which is brilliant. So that's kind of like that's the middle chapter of the continuum that I've been writing about.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I expect it's a little bit daunting too, because there's a lot of affection in the fandom for those two characters, possibly because, you know, they got so little screen time that people get very possessive of them.
Yeah, because that's very true, I think, because you've got the whole all the BBC novels, and then of course everything that Big Finish has been doing as well, and you have to be very respectful of all of that, as well as respectful of people's imagination, and that was one of the big challenges with the War Doctor novel, actually, because it was the first time anyone had done any fiction of any sort set in the Time War, and I knew it was kind of, I was worried it was a poison chalice, to be honest, because I kind of sat there and thought, whatever I do is not going to be what the Time War is in people's heads, but at the same time you go, well, all right, what do I have to do? I just have to tell the best story that I'm capable of telling. And show a slice of the Time War, because that still leaves room. And that's what I was really keen to do, is to leave room for everyone else to be able to fill it. Their version of the Time War still exists, and actually, luckily, because of what the Time War is, it can be written and rewritten and rewritten over and over again, because, you know, obviously they were rewriting history all the time. Everyone's version of the Time War still exists, no matter what's been codified by me or Big Finish. So it's kind of a nice way to look at it, I think.
Yeah, I think there is a thing, though, isn't there? I think in Moffat's Doctor Who, the Time War does have more of a linear representation in terms of timelines, whereas Russell T Davies kind of painted it as this kind of big ball of eternal fury, didn't he?
Yeah, I think that's true, actually, and that's, you know, with Engines of War, I was going for Moffat's thing, because it was intended to be a lead into the episode.
Yeah,
but yeah, I think there was definitely, I suppose, there's that thing, isn't there? I used to work for Games Workshop, and one of the things we used to talk about, I don't know how much anyone knows the Games Workshop IP, but. There's all these Space Marines, and then there's missing legions of Space Marines that have never been named, and no one knows what happened to them. And one of the things we always used to talk about is, actually, the mystery is better than knowing, because as soon as you know what it is, it's just another Space Marine.
Good point. Yeah.
And that was the worry with telling a story set in the Time War. And again, it's another reason why we went for, let's just do a slice. Let's just do a small part of the Time War. Because actually, there's still room for everything else to have occurred. And this is a kind of one theatre of war, one battle, one adventure, right at the end. When the thing, it's as much a character's journey for the Doctor and Cinder as it is a chronicle of the Time War. If you see what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, there's no way you could represent the sort of big ball of eternal fury in, certainly not on television anyway, and very difficult in novel form, I should imagine. Yeah.
I mean, it would be a great challenge, actually, but you're not going to have a typical narrative structure. You get into a really kind of weird experimental way of writing, which sounds great to me as a creative, but probably naff as a reading experience for anyone who picks the book afterwards. So yeah, that's the challenge, actually, of being faced with doing a story like that.
Okay. Well, you know, we've been chatting for nearly an hour, amazingly. let's sort of hammer things down. What should we go with first? Okay, what's going on with Doctor Who Legacy right now? We've got Bigger on the Inside. That's now out, isn't it?
Yes, Bigger Chapter on the Inside launched about 2 weeks ago. The prequel is for free in the game, and that's like 30 levels?
22? Somewhere around 20.
That launched about a year ago. And then the follow-on, Chapter 1, just launched about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, and that's in the premium area, which is...
Another 30 levels. That's over 50 levels, which is a good chunk of the first season we launched with of the game.
Yeah.
It's a lot of gameplay.
Massive. And you get all these awesome pixel costumes and some new characters like Josie from the Titan comics. That George wrote is a new ally that you collect in Chapter 1.
Okay. With Doctor Who Legacy, the game is free, isn't it? But since launch, you've introduced some various paid enhancements. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, we've started to do side packs, which are alongside the core storyline, which are things like this new Bigger on the Inside Chapter 1 is a paid pack. The Sonic Adventures, which lets you collect all the Sonic devices from through the years of Doctor Who. And we did a director's cut of the Christmas episode. So we do these little side packs, which are a way of us helping to be able to pay for more content for the game.
So how much of the game is free? I mean, what proportion of the totality of the game would you get for a
free? If you put it all together, I'd say, well, it's about 100 hours of free content.
It's got 80% of it.
Yeah,
right?
I would say it's 80-90% of it, yeah.
Well, the big stuff is probably about the first season, and then we've released four seasons plus a bunch of
It's probably
stuff.
Been the biggest challenge to selling paid packs is the fact that there's so much stuff for free. And you know, so for a new user coming in, there's so much stuff that they can do that it's very easy to think, you know, I don't really need to pay for any of this. You know, we certainly hope that players, you know, see what we're doing, love what we're doing, and want to support the game, which, you know, has always been our model. You know, there's a fan area to unlock the first time they spend a little bit of money, and the paid packs are all just, you know, as we've shown, our way of continuing to pay for new stuff.
Okay. I mean, where do you see the game in, like, this time next year, in 5 years' time? Do you think it's still going to be chugging along there?
Well, we just got another 2 years out of the BBC, so they certainly would like to hope that we're around for at least another couple of years with the game.
We'll start to talk about the next season.
Yeah, we're starting to get some insight into the new season.
So hopefully at least the next 6 months we'll be hobbling along.
Yeah, you know, as long as we can still, you know, continue to, it's 3 years out. So obviously, you know, you don't make as much money as you did when you launched the game, but as long as we can continue to bring in enough revenue to justify putting out new content, we'll keep going as long as we can. It's a lot of fun to support. It'd be a hard thing for us to grudgingly walk away from someday.
I think, yeah, but we haven't worked on anything this long.
No, definitely not.
Okay, what other things have you worked on, just for people that don't know?
Well, we've been in games for about 20 years now. So my background, a big chunk of it was at Take-Two, where I was one of the creators of 2K Games. So I signed the original Bioshock and signed Borderlands and XCOM and bought Firaxis at a bunch of studios. So that was probably the sort of biggest highlight of my career, as it was building that. Whereas Lee was at Rockstar that whole time.
Yeah, sleeping under my desk. Making the Grand Theft Auto games when I wasn't doing that.
Redesigning Bully.
The highlight of my career before Legacy was probably War of the Worlds. Going to work with Patrick Stewart and Christopher Fowler. Cool.
Another small project of ours. But yeah, we had Chris Fowler, who's a renowned horror and mystery writer in London, and Patrick Stewart. And Chris Hulsbeck, who's one of the best of the game, video game
and
music
did Doctor Legacies.
And did Doctor Legacy.
Soundtrack.
Do this homage to War of the Worlds that we did on SBLA a few years back.
Okay. I've got Chris Hulsbeck's Turrican album.
Oh, awesome! We love Chris Hulsbeck. He's awesome.
Yeah, Turrican's a fantastic piece of gaming for me. I played that a lot of times. Okay, well, that's absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about. But they're fantastic. It doesn't matter. Okay, well, I'd like to thank everyone of you for joining us on the podcast with the
Kids
this week. Susan and Lee Cummings, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Nathan Skresler and Lee Gow, thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
And George Mann, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. And Doctor Who Legacy. Bigger on the Inside is Chapter 1 is available to purchase now. Now, before you go, dear listener, thanks to the Doctor Who Legacy team, we have a code for you that will unlock some features in the game. 7922 8563 6863 9633. The code unlocks the 12th Doctor, the 12th Doctor Pixel costume, and a grab bag of miscellaneous coloured fragments, and will last until the end of the year if entered into Doctor Who Legacy. So again, the code is 7922 8563 6863 9633. So if you were using Doctor Who Legacy and you've decided to grab the code that the Doctor Who Legacy team have very kindly given to the podcast for our listeners, and then basically you go into the Doctor Who Legacy game, you download it if you haven't got it already, go into the Doctor Who Legacy game. You then go into options and then to promo, and that is where you enter the promotional code. Hope that is clear to you, dear listener. And that's all from me for this week's podcast with a K. We'll be back next week. When I say we, I do mean more than one of us. So stay tuned for that. Until next time, it's goodbye.